Session number 10601, yeah. Rule 10.
Mr. Cossier, Reel 10. You were describing the GHQ, the situation at GHQ. Would you like to take the story up from there?
Yes, Army headquarters, that was situated in the wine vaults along by the docks, you know, which are stored the wines. Very solid concrete affair. And as I rode along the beach from these checkpoints, about seven of them, I used to pick up the figures, the total of men who have been evacuated from each point of embarkation to this army headquarters.
How did you get involved in doing this activity?
I don't know. I was just seconded somehow. I was a freelance, and DRs were very few and far between, and I was just roped in. As I say, I liked the job. It just kept me occupied, much better than sitting swatting in a hole waiting for the Germans coming for you, you know.
Was there much activity on the beach in terms of enemy activity?
Yes, there was. Occasionally the Germans come along machine gunning the beaches. And, you know, you can laugh now, but it was serious then. You can imagine the waterline. And from the waterline, you've got seven queues leading right back to the sand dunes, waiting patiently for the Liberty boats to come and pick them up. Then what would happen, the Germans would come along machine gunning, then everybody would scatter back to the sand dunes for cover. So your waterline and your beach was bare for that period of time. Then when they got away, they would come back. But what used to happen, those who were in the front of the queue were now at the back for the Liberty boats, and that used to cause a lot of trouble, I suppose. You see, when they came back, they should scatter back, don't get the waterline to get an early turn for when the next Liberty boat came out. Of course, it got to a point where the Liberty boats didn't come out, and men had to swim out. Wade out and swim and climb up the ladders onto the ship. That's what I had to do, swim out and climb up the ladders onto the ship because the Liberty boats was getting stuck and the ships were getting grounded. Consequently, the Liberty boats was coming in short supply, so I thought, well, the best plan to do was to go out, swim out. You know.
How long were you on Dunkirk Beach for?
Oh, I must have been there at least 4 days. I don't know the exact date I came home, but it must have been 4 days.
How did you come to be given permission to go home?
I didn't get permission. It got to a point where it's every man for himself. These checkpoints ceased to be. When men were swimming out, they would just ignore the checkpoints and swimming out when they saw a boat drop anchor, and therefore they couldn't keep checking. I saw one petty officer pull his revolver on one of our blokes, but it was hopeless. They were just bypassing them and swimming out. And by this time, the queues weren't in existence. Instead of the queues leading from the waterline up to the sand dunes, they were horizontal with the waterline. They were all swimming out, you see. So I thought, well, this is the end for me. There's nothing to take back to Army headquarters. By the way, Field Marshal Montgomery was there. He was a brigadier then.
Did you actually see him?
Oh, aye, Brigadier. And also remember, on one occasion I drove into these wine vaults and I saw this chap getting off a small launch wearing a bowler hat, pinstripe suit, umbrella and a case. And I said to one of the lads, Sergeant Major of the Guards, he was conducting the affairs down there, and I says, who's that, Sergeant Major? He says to me, looks like the Undertaker. I says, you've got plenty of bodies then. But it's a fellow from the Home Office, Home Secretary or somebody, from the Home Office had come across to see what the situation was.
Can you tell me a little bit about the GHQ? You mentioned that you saw Montgomery there. How was it organised as far as you could see? How were you detailed to go and do your activities, and who did you report back to?
Well, these were just scribbled on numbers, scribbled on a piece of paper. There weren't a proper dispatch book on a piece of paper, figures. And I just took them into a staff sergeant, you know. But when I got in, they had these oil lamps burning, smelly, stuffy oil lamps, and ordinary army tables, like you get in the dining halls, scattered about, and an oil lamp on each table. You see, there wasn't much to see, really. Only thing is, you saw Montgomery coming out occasionally, but get a breath of fresh air, I suppose, because it was stifling there. Because it was hot weather, you know, pretty hot. And I saw Montgomery a few, he's brigadier, in and out. But Alexander was in charge. General Alexander, he was in charge.
Did you see him at all?
Oh, I saw him. And there was other brigadiers there, waiting for information from England, what the next step would be, I suppose. Waiting for an assignment, for a job to be done.
Did you get any impression of the organisation of the place? Did it look well organised, running smoothly?
No, it was chaotic. Absolutely chaotic. There was no organisation whatsoever. None whatsoever.
In what way was it chaotic?
Well, everybody was set on getting on these boats. No one was taking any orders. Nobody was taking any instructions. And every man, Jack, was set on getting on these boats. And the officers was just as bad. Because, let's face it, we then had a poor quality of officer for war. Poor quality. People blame Dunkirk and the evacuation of France. They put it down that we weren't equipped. True, we weren't equipped. But we weren't trained either. And neither was our officers. And they were a very poor bunch as compared to the TE officer and the conscript officer later on. They were good. But the regular Sandhurst officer was very, very poor under them conditions.
Can you give me any instances where which made you form this opinion?
Well, there were too much upper crust. You still had to keep the officer at arm's length like you did in peacetime. You had to be careful how you spoke to him. You couldn't associate with him like share a tin of corned beef. And they still carried the walking stick with them, directed you with a walking stick, and this cut glass accent. And always, I noticed when they were organising withdrawal, they would leave a sergeant major in charge. This always happened. They would leave a sergeant major in charge of a bridge with the excuse that they were going to go further back and reconnoitre for the further leapfrog, you know. You never saw them up at the front. And I think out of our battalion alone, there was only one decoration, military cross, and that was given to a Sergeant Major Metcalf. The officers got no decorations.
Does this apply equally to the action you described earlier on at Le Bassay or the one before that?
The Dial? Well, I never saw much of the officers in action, but just to reiterate a point there, I said that none of our officers were decorated except Metcalfe's Sergeant Major. Jay Cannon was decorated, he got the Victoria Cross. But he wasn't a Sandhurst officer. He wasn't a Sandhurst officer. He wasn't. You see, these officers still lived in the past. They were still in India drinking chota pegs and playing polo. And they couldn't get away from it. Jay Cannon wasn't one of them. But Jay got the Victoria Cross.
What about the other officers that you came across, though, when you were in action? Did you? Was it your experience with them that made you form this opinion?
Yes, yes. I've seen it with not only my own officers, but the artillery officers, the engineer officers.
Can you recall any specific examples?
No, not really, nothing concrete. But I suppose once formed the opinion of my own officers, then that opinion was there to stick. And something drastic had to happen to move my opinion. And nothing ever did happen. I still saw the same thing, pointing with his walking stick and the cut glass accent. And, you know, when we did get back to a town or village, they occupied the stanimers, which were standing still. And as one case, I went into a staminet with expectation of getting a drink myself. And there's five officers in, no other ranks. And they were guzzling behind the bar. Now, they shouldn't have been there. They should be up with the lads. They mean, they weren't DLI officers. The Royal Berks officers from the Royal Berkshire Regiment. And I lost all faith in British officers. Until later on, of course. I mean, I had a great respect for them. In Birmingham places, I had a great respect for them. Mm. But, of course, by that time, the Sanders officer was extinct. He'd either found himself a cushy job or he's too old. And now we're living with the young officer who opted to commission, emergency commissions. A lot of rankers are getting commissions. You see? Mm. What a different breed.
Returning for a moment to GHQ, you were saying that it was chaotic there and that orders were being given and presumably you were then taking these things out. Was there no one to give them to? Was this one of the problems that you had?
Well, at Dunkirk, for me, it was just a matter of fact of taking the numbers in, then hand them in coming back. I didn't carry any orders or instructions as such at Dunkirk. I didn't.
Did you form any observations or opinions about
I mean, I remember seeing Montgomery once with his hands deep in his pockets, which, to me, it gave me the couldn't care less feel, no fed up attitude, you know. Hey, that's because could have been, well, what do I do next? But again, Montgomery's just a junior officer then. He's just a brigadier. He might have been thinking to himself, well, Christ, this is beyond me attitude. But you got the attitude where nobody seemed to care. The main thing was getting on the boats. And at that point, even when I got on the boat, I didn't know we were going home.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that earlier on. Can you tell me about your journey home?
Yes. I swam out, and I found that, again, the battle dress was cumbersome. It was filling out like a balloon, my tunic. So I took it off and ditched it. Now then, what I'd done, I ditched my pay book, which was in my pocket, and my birth certificate, which was in my pocket. Because later on, when I come to get married, I had to send away for a birth certificate. This battle dress just ballooned out. Throw it off, and I got on a ship called the Lady of Man. The Lady of Man.
What kind of ship was that? Can you recall?
I think it had been a cargo ship. It wasn't very big. Cargo ship, I would think. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't a passenger ship. It wasn't. I wouldn't know what tonnage it was. But anyhow, I got on that, climbed up the ladders, and it was chock-a-block. They were lying about all over. And I was given a Mayor West. And I just lay down, and I went sound asleep. I used the Mayor West for a pillow. and I fell sound asleep. And I didn't know nothing until somebody woke me up and said, "We're at Margate." And that's the first time I knew we were going to England. I thought we were going up the coast to make another tack somewhere. And
what was your reaction when you were told you were at Margate?
Absolutely disgusted. Because when we pulled into Margate, there was the Lord Mayor standing with his chain of office on, and all the public waving and cheering. And I thought, well, what have they got to wave and cheer about? We've left France in hell of a state. And I was really disgusted. I thought, hey, heavens, what's the British Army coming to? I'll put that. Are you all right for the night?
Did the other lads feel the same as you, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I was asleep all the way across the channel. And, of course, apart from that, they're all cosmopolitan. I wouldn't have had much to do with them in any case. The first time I met a DLI was later, much, much later on at Huddersfield.
Can you tell me what... You said there was this public reception, as it were, with brass bands playing and crowds there. Were you given anything in any way when you got off the boat?
When we got off the boat, we marched to the station. And we bought this train. Lovely fine day. And we went to a place called Dursley. And going up in the train, I'd getting a bit grit in the eye looking out the window. Now, as I said before, I was very disillusioned with the whole situation. But travelling up from Margate to Dursley in the train, I changed my opinion. Because when I was looking out the window, I could see people playing tennis in white shorts. You know, couldn't care less attitude. And I thought, well, what the hell am I worrying about? And that changed my opinion. And we got to Dursley, and it was like, I think it was a school or a church hall. We all lined up, and I had blankets done for us to lie down on these blankets. And they came out with a mug of tea and a pasty. And the MO came around asking us if we had any injuries or wounds. And I had this bit of grit in my eye. It was killing me. But I durstn't tell him. I thought the chaps, they were legs off and arms off. Here's me complaining about a bit of grit. So I just shook my head and said, no, sir. You know, walked past. But next morning, it's gone anyhow. We just stopped there overnight.
Was that the first food and drink you'd been given since
yes.
you got on the boat?
Pot of tea there and a pasty. Next morning, we got beans and bully beef, and biscuits. No bread. Beans and bully beef. Then again, we went on a train. And this time, it went to Huddersfield. And this is where I met this lad, Ginger, who worked in the QM stores. Him and I piled up for a few days, him being the only DLI there, like, on that train, because it was all odds and sods. Now, when we got to Huddersfield, we were sorted out in units on the platform. And units, DLIs and Royal Berks, Royal Welsh. Then there was a fleet of buses outside the station to pick us up. We were on the buses and we were driven around this residential area, posh. And apparently these people had agreed to take one or more in, you see. And of course, Ginger, he was as shy and as bashful as what I was. They're driving round and round. Then we were the two last guys left. And the bus stopped. Like this lady was standing at the door. And I always remember, it's the first time I ever saw a woman with painted toenails. She was standing at the door wearing sandals, painted toenails. And we were the last two. And we went to her house. And again, I always remember that thick piled carpet along the corridor, And I tried to walk on the side to keep off the carpet because my boots was in oil and grease off the bike. And that, you know. And by the hall stand. You see? Now then, when we first arrived off the boat at Dunkirk, my revolver was taken off me because there were shorter revolvers for officers and I was given a rifle. Now, when we walked up this passage, I walked on the side to avoid treading on the carpet. There was a hall stand and I always remember I put my rifle in there and I had a blanket. We were given a blanket and I folded the blanket up nice and neat and put it on the side next to the hall stand. And we were told to go up this room, the lounge, and this old chap was sitting, grey-headed chap sitting. And of course, we didn't sit in easy chairs. Ginger and I sat on the two stiff chairs like two bookends, you know. And it turned out that the occupier of this house, the man of this house, he was a manager of a foundry. Making aircraft parts for aircraft engines. And this old chap was the father of his wife. And he had been the First World War as an American doctor in the First World War, because he's all about the casualties and that, you know. And I asked on the field of war, I says, what were you? And he says, I was a captain of the medical corps, American Army. And
how long were you actually placed in this billet?
Well, I was just there 3 days.
Did they treat you well?
Oh, yes. We'd just been sitting maybe 10 minutes when she said the bath is ready for a bath. Okay, fair enough. Because we're in a hell of a state. I remember going to this posh bathroom with all the salts on the wall and putting a little bit of that before very long, it's coming over the top. I remember when I was finished, I made a few splashes and I was getting toilet paper and cleaning it up, you know, on the floor. I didn't want to make a mess because Ginger was coming in next. And we got our dinners. That two servants served dinner and that. And, of course, had the freedom of the town. The baths was free. The buses was free to us. If you went to a pub, the lad didn't go at night. They reckon your beer was bought for you. And I remember this lady in charge of this house, a woman that belonged to the house, she's very pleased. She dropped on two men who didn't drink or smoked. You see? Because they said, you've got to say, well, I don't drink, and Ginger didn't drink. Neither of us smoked. And that was for the blackouts, you know. And at night time, we got a tot of whiskey to go to bed with. And when I went to bed, Ginger and I, old army style, we took our trousers off, folded them up, and put them under the pillow, you know, to get a crease, the old army. And when the maid came in next morning with a cup of tea, she saw that. She said, what's that? I was wearing our trousers getting pressed. She said, give us them here. And she pressed them. And
were you at all overawed by this house that you were in, do you think?
Yes. Because next day, the lady of the house asked us if we preferred our meals alone. And I think she must have realised that we were embarrassed with this cutlery and serviettes and finger bowls and what have you. Something we weren't accustomed to. And we welcomed the change. You know, we took in and we preferred it that way.
You said earlier on as well there was the sort of freedom of the town to those people who come back from Dunkirk. Did you go out yourself and find that the people wouldn't let you pay for anything?
Yes, I went out the swimming baths. And they wouldn't let me pay for it to go in the swimming baths. The buses. Wouldn't let me pay on the buses. And for what I gather, when you went to a pub, the locals was buying the beer. And I was a bit bored stiff, and I went into this nursery, gardens and nursery, to have a look around, you know, they welcomed you in. And I came up with a dripping bunch of flowers. But my landlady was pleased with these, you know, and she had flowers all over the place. Oh, they're very good in Huddersfield to us, very good.
How long did you stay in this billet for?
Well, I stayed about 3 days.
And then where did you go?
I went to sort of a church hall, if I remember correctly. Because the battalion was starting to reform, and battalion headquarters was forming up. And since I was one of the only survivors at the original battalion headquarters, they gave me a brand new 500cc Norton motorbike.
What did you feel about that?
Oh, really proud, really great. Because the weather was good, fine, and I was circuit dispatch rider, which meant I travelled to Halifax, Leeds, the sort of a triangle, and more or less 8-to-5 job.
So you're still attached to Battalion HQ?
Oh, yes, I'm in Battalion. I'm back in the battalion. We're a new faces, new characters, you know. The other lads have been taken prisoner, you see.
What would you say at that early stage after Dunkirk morale was like in the Battalion HQ?
Well, I don't think there was any morale as such. Everybody was too busy getting about, you know, reforming and doing the job and getting re-equipped. You know, there was no sort of sadness or regrets shown. It was just get stuck in and let's get cracking again sort of attitude. You know, I never felt nothing.
You said you were a circuit dispatch rider. What did that entail?
Well, you see that they were forming the battalion again at Huddersfield. And I suppose I had to be equipped with rifles, Bren guns, uniforms. And what I carried my dispatch, I didn't know because it was all buff envelope. But I was going to ordnances, you see, in Leeds and Halifax, service corps departments. So I suppose it'd be requisitions for material, I suppose, what was needed.
And you said it was a 9-to-5 job?
More or less, 8-to-5, more or less.
So how did you spend the rest of your day?
Well, I should go down to swim baths in night time. I'd go to the cinema. Of course, we weren't there very long, only about a fortnight. Then we'd come further north into Yorkshire, to Brinleyden, Carnaby.
And was that a camp?
Mostly houses, requisitioned houses. Except for a few huts.
And where were you billeted?
Well, then, I got orders from Huddersfield to make my way to North Yorkshire, Brinleyden, a small village called Carnaby, about 3 miles inland from Brinleyden, a little village. And that's where battalion headquarters was situated. Now, you can understand, battalion was coming back to take up coastal positions in the event of an invasion on the northeast coast of Britain. So battalion headquarters wouldn't be established on the coastline. We were 3 miles behind in a farmhouse in a place called Carnaby, a little village. But the battalion was more or less billeted in these requisitioned houses on the seafront.
And they were still living with the families?
No. The families had evacuated. The army had requisitioned them. Lovely houses. Terraced houses. Well, the boarding houses. Peacetime. And we did occupy a caravan site at Brinleyden as well, further up the coast.
What was the battalion HQ like where you were billeted?
Well, I was in a barn, quite comfortable, plenty of straw. Battalion headquarters was in a house, which had been requisitioned. And for the guard room, we had this wooden hut. And for the detention room at a wooden hut.
So you took on your own old role as a military policeman?
Yes, sir. Regimental policeman, really. Regimental policeman. Uh-huh. And, of course, I was promoted Lance Corporal.
When did you receive news of that?
What?
Of your promotion?
At Carnaby.
Why do you think you were promoted?
Well, I think mostly because I had previous experience. And now, shall we say, war experience. And the chaps who were drafting in to the regiment police couldn't even ride a motorbike. So I got the job of teaching them how to ride a motorbike. And I suppose it's because of my experience.
How many people were you in charge of?
Well, no, I wasn't in charge. They fetched a sergeant in from Wrighton. He'd been a bouncer, I suppose, in the peacetime. Public House bouncer, the looks of him. They brought him in and other two privates. So the sergeant was in charge, actually. But again, he could ride a motorbike and he had no knowledge whatsoever of any military procedure court martial, but he had not had court martial procedure. He had no knowledge of ordinary room procedure. He couldn't read a map, map references. He had no idea how to read a map references, which is a funny story later on. As a matter of fact, I don't know how he got three stripes. But he wasn't with it very long because I took his place eventually.
How did he get on with him, bearing in mind that he couldn't do it?
Well, he had lean on my shoulder a lot, you see. And again, he was a boozer himself, heavy drinker, and which didn't work very well with me. And I got on well with the fact that he had to depend upon me for everything. Had to make the charge sheets out and what have you. But I think it was a rush job, you know. They couldn't very well put me from private to sergeant. And I think Colonel Ian, who was then commander of battalion, because our other colonels didn't be taken prisoner, the plan was taken by Colonel Ian, who was my depot commander in peacetime, who presented me with a silver cane. You see? So him and I were best of pals, as it may seem, you know. And rather strange to get on well with the colonel, but he was a colonel that he had no love for nobody. Colonel Ian was a fine officer, voting war officer. Again, he was too old. He was sent to us because he was a strict man.